Hello, and welcome to Friends for Life, a podcast of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod's National Mission. We're here to come alongside you as we journey through life under the cross. What does it look like to care for our neighbors in body and soul? How do we tend to our own body and soul? How can we speak up for life? And finally, how do we share the faith with the next generation? Join us as we have these conversations and learn together. We hope you'll stick around and be our friends for life.
Thanks so much for joining us. I'm your host, Steph Neugebauer, here with my guests, Dr. Kara Bratton and Dr. Belinda Karge. They're going to be sharing with us how to grow resilient minds in ourselves and how to shape resilient minds in our young people. Before we move ahead, it's important to note that we are not licensed counselors or therapists. Our discussion today is from the perspective of fellow Christians who care for our neighbors. Dr. Karge, Dr. Bratton, welcome. Is it okay with you if I call you by your first names?
Absolutely.
Yes, please do.
We prefer that.
So Dr. Belinda Karge we have here and Dr. Kara Bratton we have here. So Belinda and Kara, it's a pleasure to have you on. Would you please take a moment to introduce both of yourselves and then maybe even just for fun, tell us how you both connected to create this curriculum?
Absolutely. Hi, everybody. I feel honored to be here and I feel very blessed that the Lord has allowed us to be together today. I work at Concordia University Irvine. This is my ninth year there. I work in the doctoral program, which means that I am training administrators, future leaders, future teachers, nonprofit coordinators, organizational folks. In the doctoral program at Concordia University, we have strands in special education, ed leadership, as well as organizational change. Prior to that, I worked in many other universities, both here in the United States as well as other places in the world. My husband was military. He's now retired. So we've traveled and I have taught preschool, elementary school, middle school, and high school just because of our world travelers. You know, sometimes you spend a year, which I did in Japan, a year in Pisa, Italy, as well as spending much time in Southern California, as well as the Midwest. My family is from South Dakota. So been travelers and enjoyed that journey. I really feel that mental health is an issue that we all need to pay attention to. And just so you know, we started thinking about this curriculum long before the pandemic. I worked with a colleague who is a clinical counselor, Dr. Jeremiah Stokes. He's a third author on our curriculum at Concordia. And he and I spent a lot of time just talking about similarities. I, as a past special education teacher, and he as a clinical counselor. And we started comparing notes of the types of students we worked with, the types of things we were seeing in the field. I was sharing with him the types of things I was called in to regular education, general education classrooms to support teachers on. And we said, you know, we really should put together something that might be beneficial to many different people. And when you think about it, you know, in a world with increasing concerns for mental health for young people, it's really important that children have a proper education and practices to promote mental wellness. So thinking about that, we started working on a secular curriculum. And we didn't get very far because both of us are believers and everything we talked about just went right back to the Bible. And, you know, you really have to think about that everlasting and steadfast love that Jesus Christ provides. And if you think of it that way, it was for us a slam dunk to write a Christian curriculum. And at that point, as we started to write the curriculum, I had recently met Dr. Bratton. And she was adjuncting for Concordia Irvine. And we started talking and we just had this shared love for research and for students and for Jesus and just working together. And one thing led to another. And pretty soon I was like, hey, do you want to work on this curriculum with us? And so the three of us have really collaborated very well together and been able to move forward. When I'm not writing, I'm a research geek. I love to read articles. I like to read books. I like to spend my time with my 2 and 5-year-old nephews who are in Southern California. Concordia is in Southern California. However, I also do spend a lot of time in Arizona and in South Dakota because my family has homes in both of those places.
So I'm Kara Bratton. So like Belinda, I work at Concordia University Irvine in the doctoral program. I am just finishing up actually my first year as a full-time professor, which has been wonderful. And as Belinda mentioned, we met right before I started adjuncting for Concordia. So I had done some adjunct work for them for a few years before moving into full-time. So my background prior to full-time at Concordia was also in special education. I spent 11 years teaching K-8 special education in Lutheran schools where I live in Fort Wayne, Indiana. And then I moved on to do special education administration for Lutheran schools. So that encompassed working in any of the 50 states in the U.S. And also allowed me to spend some time internationally at Concordia International School in Hanoi, Vietnam, which was an amazing experience. So again, just a lot of experience in special ed. And because of that, you know, I was seeing, you know, as Belinda said, prior to the pandemic, you know, I felt like I knew a lot about special ed and the academic piece. And then I had teachers and administrators coming to me about, you know, challenging behaviors, which, again, that connection to mental health is pretty significant. And I, you know, initially was like, I don't know much about behavior. I don't know how I can help. And I pretty quickly got tired of saying, I don't know much about this. I don't know how to help. So I, you know, moved into like, okay, I need to really invest time and energy and resources into, you know, how do we help kids with behavior? And, you know, that again, that connection to mental health and all of those things. So, you know, that just kind of expanded, again, my own research, my own interests. And I was working on my PhD at that time as well. So all of that just interconnected and again, connected me to Belinda and, you know, feeling like I could, you know, use some of my gifts that God has given me to connect with the curriculum. I live in Fort Wayne, Indiana, so not quite as scenic as California and Arizona, but I do like to spend time outside as well. I would say hiking, but really in northern Indiana, it's more like walking because it's very flat. But anytime outdoors that I can spend, cycling, you know, hiking, walking, anything like that, I love. Also love spending time with my nieces and nephews. They're my life. So anything kind of fun I can do to take them out and spoil them, that's just kind of my free time as well, along with research and reading. Those are, again, similar to Belinda. So I'm, again, excited about this curriculum and hope that it can, you know, help everyone out there, you know, pastors, teachers, DCEs, parents even, just again, explore these topics, which have become so important in our world.
Not only do you have a love for children, but you also have a special care and concern for mental health. And so you two are the perfect people to be talking to today about how we can build resiliency. And we're going to get into what that means and some tips and tricks for how we can do that. But first, Belinda, what made you want to compile this curriculum for our young people, our youth, on mental health?
When Dr. Stokes and I were talking about just writing together initially, we weren't even talking mental health at that time, we started sharing how it seemed like the schools, both public and private, were going down this deficit road, like always looking for things that are wrong with kids. And we're like, why is that? They should be using a strength-based approach. It should be all about God's gifts, and we should be focusing on those gifts. And as we started to talk, we realized that it really was important to think about mental wellness. And mental wellness means looking forward and really thinking about how we can focus on the gifts that we were given and honor that in each individual person. And so that's why we thought, okay, we need to put together this Christ-centered curriculum that's designed to really focus in. And at that point, we right away said adolescence, middle school. Although right now we are writing a high school version, and eventually we will write an elementary and preschool version. But, you know, where we felt the most problem areas that we were seeing in schools were basically some lost adolescents, you know, people who just really did not understand the world as we thought they should see it, meaning that more Christ-centered, very positive, looking at your gifts, honoring who you are and what you are, and learning about how to handle situations in your life. So that really, you know, led us down the road of compiling this curriculum and researching mental health. Because what we learned is that in the counselor world, where Dr. Stotz lives and what he does clinical-wise, everything is very medically focused. In the education world, where I live and Dr. Bratton live, is we are in a situation where we really do focus more on the child development side, the development of the youth side. We focus more on what I would call the whole child in terms of the way education is set up. Not that a counselor doesn't, but as we started comparing the research in the area, that's where we started to see the connection and saw the value of combining the strength of education and the strength of the counseling together in one curriculum.
And Kara, what kind of needs were you and Belinda and Dr. Stotz hoping to address through this curriculum?
Yeah, well, obviously, when we talk about, you know, writing a mental health curriculum, and we've, as we've presented on this many times, you know, we've gotten questions like, oh, did you include this? Did you include this? And, you know, we say, you know, it's a huge, obviously, area. So we had to streamline and pick and choose what was going to be included. And also, when we talked with our publisher, you know, initially we had ideas about, you know, writing more lessons, and, you know, they really wanted to keep it to about 12 lessons, which is what this is. So obviously there's a limited amount of topics you can cover, but we really, as Belinda said, coming from that strength-based perspective, thought about what are those topics that are really impacting kids the most, you know, and how can we, again, kind of conceptualize and, you know, make include as much as we can in those 12 lessons where, again, we're focusing on strengths. We're not focusing on, you know, diagnosing kids or things like that, but really, you know, how can we explore those God-given gifts? So we kind of had that filter as we, you know, we're thinking about topics, but, you know, some of those very prevalent topics like anxiety and, you know, anger and things that, you know, all really kind of interconnect in how God has designed our brain. So we do spend time at the beginning teaching kids about, you know, how God did design our brains, you know, and that's a beautiful thing. But, you know, that understanding can lead to, you know, understanding, well, how does anxiety work? What is happening in my brain? You know, things like anger. So we kind of used those to kind of guide some of those topics. There was obviously much more we could have included. But, you know, we chose to kind of focus and go in depth on some of those things. And again, that connection to scripture was very important as well.
Your curriculum is called Resilient Minds. Belinda, what does it mean to be resilient?
In our case, we're talking about mental resiliency. And mental resiliency is that ability to adapt to stress or adversity or trauma or anything that's going on in your life presently, as Kara talked about, related to the brain. It involves those mental processes and the behaviors that help individuals navigate through like difficult experiences and difficult times without being overwhelmed or succumbing to those negative emotions or outcomes. So when I think about resiliency in general, but in our case, again, focusing on mental resiliency, I think about a positive outlook and maintaining optimism and hopefully an outlook even in the face of adversity, which can help in finding solutions and, you know, coping with strategies and really adapting, being flexible, being able to adjust to new circumstances. You know, we talk in our curriculum about self-efficacy, which means believing in your own ability to handle the challenges and to achieve goals, which foster like motivation and perseverance and just that whole idea of feeling confident about who you are. And of course, mental resilience is problem-solving skills. So important to think about how we analyze situations when somebody calls us a name, when we're uncomfortable with a situation, when somebody gets too close to us, when we're in a place where we're not feeling like we should be, you know, and then identifying solutions and, you know, taking a decisive action on that and feeling comfortable with that. So that does alleviate stress in our lives. And that's something we need to do as adults. you know, it's not just the kids. So mental resilience is, like I said, it's not about avoiding stress or hardships, but it's about facing it head on. learning from the experiences, growing stronger as a result. And, you know, it can be developed through practices, you know, cognitive reframing, building social connections. And of course, when things get out of hand, seeking professional support. And as we shared, Dr. Bratton and I are not clinical counselors or psychologists. And throughout the book, there are counseling notes that Dr. Stokes wrote. And we try very hard to remind whoever's using the curriculum that if you see certain behaviors, yes, reach out, go to the professional.
And I was just going to chime in too with resiliency. I think if anyone's familiar with, you know, Carol Dweck's work and growth mindset versus fixed mindset, you know, that's really impactful to students and their development. You know, again, if they come at, you know, life with that growth mindset where, you know, my abilities are not fixed, I can always, you know, improve, I can get better, I can learn more. And that's really what resiliency is that we can practice these skills. You know, our brains need to practice resiliency. It's not just like we're resilient or we're not, but we need to, you know, learn and teach adolescents how to develop those skills, you know, versus if there's that fixed mindset, we're like, no, I'm not good at that. I can't handle this. And then they just kind of go into shutdown mode. So kind of that lack of resiliency. So it's not either or. Again, we can help, you know, anybody, you know, kids and adults, you know, develop that growth mindset and the ability to be resilient.
Agree.
Both of you have been in education for some time and have had a plethora of experiences that have exposed you to many different children and behaviors. Have you seen over the decades, children specifically here, we're talking about adolescents, lose resilience? Is it a matter of that, or is it that adults have lost the awareness that we need to help them build resilience? Or is it something else altogether that I'm missing?
I mean, I've seen a couple different things. And honestly, a presentation I heard a couple months ago was talking about research from different areas of adolescence. And one of the things they were showing is even since I think it was about 2018, so just prior to the pandemic, the rates of adolescents who were willing to take risks and to go into unknowns, it was like this steep drop off and even declined further since the pandemic. So it's just showing that, again, our youth are like less willing to put themselves out there and take risks. Now, that just, again, kind of showed the research behind it didn't really go into why that was happening. But again, that was even prior to the pandemic. And I would see in my educational experience in working with schools, you know, another thing that would happen is parents or adults or sometimes teachers step in and they think they're being helpful and just solve the problem for the child and think like, okay, this child is, you know, really experiencing like an anxiety attack or high stress. So let me just go in and take care of the issue, you know, without realizing, you know, that actually does the opposite. It increases anxiety and just reinforces the idea that child, you know, that in that child's mind, they're thinking, oh, I was right. I can't handle this. I need an adult to step in. So they're not developing those resiliency skills because they're not being given the opportunity to problem solve, and they're not being given the tools to help them get through it when an adult or, you know, well-meaning individual steps in and does it for them.
Even when we were putting together this curriculum, we went and piloted some of our ideas at various schools across the United States. And what would happen a lot is that the teachers wanted to just lecture. Like they wanted to be the ones to just give the information, even though each lesson has activities and a strategy intentionally to get kids talking and to have them discuss and have them use their brains and use their minds and think about, you know, what do they believe is going on with that particular topic. The teachers just wanted to like tell them. And so we, you know, we ended up actually doing some modeling. Like Kara and I, we co-taught a couple of classes, and afterward we debriefed with the teachers, and the teachers were like, oh, now we understand why you wanted the kids to be talking. Now we understand the importance of getting these eighth graders in groups and allowing them to have conversations, because they build on each other in a much different way than what they would do if they were, for example, just talking to an adult, which in our pandemic world, they've been spending a lot of time talking with adults. Yeah.
Kara, you mentioned, the interconnection between anxiety and anger. How might anxiety, anger, and even fear in an adolescent affect their ability to be resilient in those moments?
Yeah. So as I mentioned, they're all really interconnected. And that goes back to, how God designed our brains. Our brains are always looking for safety, and they're always looking for threats to safety. Even just, subconsciously, we don't realize that at all times, our brain is taking in input from everywhere and everything and deciding, are we safe or are we not safe? So one of the things with, the big thing with anxiety is that information coming into the brain, and the brain is saying, no, we're not safe. Even, in instances where you or I might say, oh, there's nothing wrong with this situation, there's nothing to be afraid of. The brains, when we're experiencing that intense anxiety, or an individual with an anxiety disorder, their brains are processing things differently. So their brain is saying, well, alarm, we're in danger, we need to respond. And the response from the brain is that fight, flight, or freeze mode. And that's an automatic reaction, that there's not that cognition of like, oh, wait, this isn't really something I need to be worried about. It's the brain taking over and just, responding in that way. So when that brain is in that automatic mode, it's not thinking and not making the connection to those cognitive skills where resilience comes in, where it's like, oh, I have a strategy, let me slow down and think about how I need to do this. So when we build those skills of resiliency, those can become more automatic and more of an automatic response. So the more those are practiced, then when that brain goes into that fight, flight, or freeze mode, then, that individual could have the ability to say, wait, hold on a second. I have other skills I can utilize to get through this. So it's all, again, interconnected. And I think what a lot of times, no matter what your role is with adolescents or even adults, is that understanding that when that brain is in fight, flight, or freeze mode, and again, those intense periods of anxiety, fear, those types of things, is that access to those cognitive skills and that logical and critical thinking are oftentimes completely cut off. So there is no way for the brain to, access some of those skills in that moment. So the strategies we talk about, again, whether they're strategies for anxiety, strategies for anger, it's all about slowing the brain down. How can we, again, access those critical thinking, those logical skills that we can't access when we're in that fight, flight, or freeze mode? So things like, the box breathing, grounding techniques, all these different strategies we talk about, that's really their goal, is to slow the brain down so that we can then access those cognitive skills. And I think when we sometimes respond so quickly to an adolescent or individual when they're in like that heightened state, again, without realizing that they don't have the ability to, bring in those skills at that time, that we just need to give them time, again, to calm down, kind of reintegrate. And then we can talk about, consequences or the logic, behind things or what needs to happen next.
I want to get into those specific tactics and strategies that you had mentioned. But before we do, I think it's important to say first why you approached this curriculum from a strength-based perspective, what you called a strength-based perspective, rather than from the point of deficit, especially when we're presenting something to our young people.
Right. Well, and I think it picks right up on where Kara left off in terms of like talking about negative thought patterns. So anxiety and fear, they lead to those negative thought patterns, and then all of a sudden it becomes worse, and the child or the adolescent is overestimating the risk, and they have this whole pessimistic outlook, and, downhill it goes. And so in thinking through this, we thought, okay, we need to flip that. We want to really focus on capabilities, focus on positive attributes. rather than solely on like problems and deficits. And it really does mean recognizing and building upon truly inherent strengths and resources to promote that resilience and that growth and that well-being. So that means taking the time to discover what those are. And that's one of the things we try to do with our activities and during the curriculum is to really identify those strengths and help the adolescent know that they have unique strengths. And those strengths could be creativity, it could be empathy, it could be, you know, compassion, whatever those strengths are, how they can use them to best facilitate and enhance their own wellness. The other thing, you know, a lot of people don't like to use the term empowerment. I personally love that term because I feel, you know, when young people are empowered to see themselves in a positive light, that's when they recognize their own potential to overcome lots of difficulties and things that they deal with. We have something in the curriculum called resilience building, and that is encouraging these young people to not only draw upon their strengths, but build upon their strengths. So once I know that I'm very creative, what do I do with that creativity? You know, how do I use that gift to support those around me, to support myself, to support my family? Once I know that I have a lot of compassion, how do I use the gift of compassion to build social skills or to build friendships? How does that work? So we try to take that kind of second step of that resilience building as we think about a strength-based. If Dr. Stokes were here, he would bring up the whole fact of, on the counseling side, a strength-based is really looking at every piece, physical, emotional, mental. My mind is blanking here, Kara, help me out.
Spiritual, did you say spiritual?
Well, thank you. You know, just looking at all those pieces together and putting together a profile that's individual to that student that they can then use and see that as a wellness path for their own lives.
I'd love to hear from both of you on this. What are some specific strategies that you've provided in your curriculum that help these young people develop resiliency, build off of their strengths? Kara, you mentioned box breathing, grounding techniques. Can you explain just for the average person, I'm not sure that they're aware of what those terms even mean. So how do those help? What are some specific strategies? And I'm guessing that these aren't only helpful or applicable to adolescents, but probably are very helpful to adults going through similar experiences.
Sure. Yeah. And just to your point, first off, yes, these definitely, they're not limited to adolescents or any age. And, you know, we always recommend, you know, adults, teachers, you know, DCs, whoever is working with the kid, you know, one, this helps your own mental health. I found myself utilizing them more and more as we have researched these different strategies as well. But, you know, modeling those for kids, I can't tell you how many times, like when I was teaching before I knew some of these strategies, where it was like, okay, just take a deep breath. Well, if you've ever, you know, told a 10-year-old to take a deep breath without practicing it, sometimes it's like they're just hyperventilate. They don't really know how to, you know, implement some of these strategies. So that's where, you know, we really try to explicitly lay out. So for example, box breathing. And you can see like box breathing, if you Google it, you know, there's all kinds of different ways. Belinda and I were at a presentation where someone demonstrated box breathing and we're sitting there like they're doing it wrong. So box breathing is, again, I know you can't see me, but if you take your fingers, you're kind of making a box at the same time. So you are inhaling for four as you kind of make that horizontal line. And then you are holding your breath for four, and then you are exhaling, and then again, holding for four. So it kind of completes that box. So again, the effect is it's slowing down your breathing. It's not just, hey, take some deep breaths. And there are numerous breathing strategies like that. But again, for anxiety, for anger, all of those things that are, as I mentioned, slowing down your brain so your brain can really process. So you might have to do that more than one time, but, you know, explicitly modeling and even throughout the day, you know, not just within if you're teaching these lessons. But I love it when I see, you know, teachers get escalated or DCEs, whoever's working with a child, the parent, you know, they get escalated as well when children are kind of, you know, flying off the handle or kind of becoming dysregulated. So it's also a good time for the adult to say, you know what, I need to practice box breathing too. Let's do it together. Or even if it's a time when maybe, you know, the adult is, you know, needs that and the child doesn't, it's just really powerful for the adult to model that throughout the day. The other one you mentioned, and I'll let Belinda chime in, is that grounding technique. So that's, again, when there's maybe, you know, emotions are escalated, you're feeling dysregulated. That's thinking of 5 things you can see in the moment, 4 things you can touch, 3 things you can hear, 2 things you can smell, and 1 thing you can taste. So again, it's just slowing you down and getting you to think about something. That's the key to, is that there's an element of cognition in these strategies, which again helps to access those cognition skills that, you know, I've mentioned kind of fly out the window when we become dysregulated, or, you know, some of those, you know, anxiety and things like that kind of take over. So those are a couple of my favorite strategies. I'll mention one more, that practicing gratitude, you know, and this is, I think, just goes along with our prayer life as Christians too, but really being intentional about, you know, thinking like, oh, you know, the world is ending, like my life is horrible, you know, which we all get in those modes sometimes, but I think sometimes adolescents don't know how to see their way out of that. So making intentional time to, you know, say, okay, what are 3 things that I'm grateful for? And I found in my own life, when I start to do that, I've been doing it at the end of the day, adding that to my prayer life. And I start with 3 and it snowballs. I'm like, oh, there's so much more to be grateful for today, even if maybe I thought, oh, this was just kind of a kind of day. Like I just wasn't feeling great about how today went. And when I try to think of 3 things that I'm grateful for, it, like I said, just ends up being, you know, 10 or 12. And I'm like, you know what? There's so many more good things than bad things. So I think that's another very powerful strategy. And again, a lot of research behind that it lowers anxiety and depression, increases even heart health and things like that. So that's a really powerful thing for anybody.
Mm-hmm. We could talk forever. There's so many cool strategies. We have a student journal that goes along with our curriculum. We did that on purpose, so they'd have something they can take home. And what I love the way Concordia Publishing did this was they put a little box at the end of every lesson that has a strategy. I was just looking at my favorite, which is the belly breathing, and there's just specific steps. So a student could cut this out and, like, you know, color it if they wanted and put it up in their room to remind them, or put it on their, you know, their mirror. Or we as adults, once we learn the strategy, we just use them. The belly breathing is, you know, close your eyes and sit or stand in a really comfortable position, and then put both of your hands on the center of your belly. And then you breathe in really slowly through your nose. You count to 5. And then you think about how full of air your belly is getting. And then you breathe out slowly through your nose, count to 5, and you repeat it. And then you open your eyes and you feel, wow, I'm really calm. Or another one I love is called Take Control of Your Thoughts. And that is to really spend some time thinking about what you like about your life. Think about what makes you happy. At one point, it's also referred to as visualizing special places. And I recently did this. I had to have surgery last year on my nose, and it was quite scary. It's the first time I'd ever had surgery like that. And I used the strategy. We had just written about it, and I used the strategy to visualize myself walking with my husband on the river and just relaxing, and it just really worked in terms of supporting myself. Another idea that I love with controlling thoughts is just thinking about Bible verses. You know, for me, I love verses like the fruit of the Spirit: love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, self-control. I love thinking about that and how I can use those in my life to be a better person. And in the curriculum, we encourage the adolescents to memorize Bible verses so that when you are alone with yourself and your own thoughts, maybe that's something you want to pull up, you know, and you can actually use that as a strategy to equip you to really strive for mental wellness.
in your curriculum, you have a section on healthy perspective. How is a healthy perspective an important part of regulating your mental state, but also building toward resilience, even in the face of adversity? Certainly, we can have a healthy perspective on even a challenging situation. So what does that look like, and how can we help foster that in our children?
Yeah, absolutely. Having a healthy perspective involves just having balance and realistic views of yourself, of others, of the world. And that enables us to really navigate our life's challenges effectively and to maintain mental well-being. Some of the things we think about when we consider healthy perspective are things like self-awareness and helping our adolescents understand emotions and values and be aware of things that occur in their life. Encouraging, of course, the positive thinking like we've been talking about before. Building emotional regulation, that's huge. And we have quite a few strategies in the curriculum that teach coping, such as the deep breathing we just talked about. We have a few mindfulness strategies. We have a couple of problem-solving techniques just to help think about how we navigate and regulate emotions effectively to build a healthy perspective. I also think it's important to really focus in when professional help is needed and not to shy away from professional help. Again, we talk to the teachers in the curriculum about going ahead and looking for certain signs that a child may need more than what they can give. And in those counselor notes, Dr. Stokes talks about some of those signs and kind of what to look for and how important, if you see somebody who's constantly alone, who's constantly pulling away, and as you're building out some of these strategies and asking students to converse and whatnot, and that student is still a loner, that's probably a student who might need a little bit more than what we can give. And in order to help them build a healthy perspective, it would be important to go ahead and refer that student for counseling and to not shy away from things like that. But I think the bottom line of healthy perspective is to promote real healthy interactions and activities, the way that we can help everybody grow in emotional resilience, social skills, overall well-being into adulthood.
Yeah, and if I can just add to you, I think we'd be remiss without mentioning, we don't in the curriculum, but specifically, but just the role of social media in healthy perspectives, especially for adolescents. And if we think too about social media, really the, you know, addiction, if you will, is really more about connection. You know, the human brain, our nervous systems, like that's one of the things we can't live without is connection. So when we think about, you know, adolescents and social media or ourselves as adults and social media, it's about this is the way to connect. And this is the way adolescents are connecting right now. So I also think as adults, you know, we need to go back to modeling that perspective of, you know, again, social media, it shows a lot, but what's real on social media, again, what's filtered, you know, just having those discussions with adolescents that like, yeah, again, you might connect with your friends and things like this, but this is, you know, we need to model that perspective and say that, okay, let's have connections in other ways, you know, other than just online or, you know, modeling for our kids. Hey, when we're at the dinner table, when we're doing this, you know, phones away, that kind of thing. So I think that perspective, again, involving technology, I mean, we could spend, you know, hours talking about that in and of itself. But I think that we do need to remember to, you know, lead by example with that. And again, have those limits in place and just help kids understand, you know, what's real and what, you know, that perspective when it comes to social media as well.
Yeah.
Now, how does mental health not only affect the person, but affect their relationships? So affect how adolescents relate one to another, or even how adults relate to their children, to the people that are in their care. Certainly there's a ripple effect of mental health and resilient minds, not just for the good of oneself, but for the good of neighbors. So what would those maybe be, Dr. Bratton?
Yeah, so I think, you know, one, when we were writing this curriculum, again, we wrote it not to be diagnostic, not to be, you know, like differentiating necessarily between kids with, you know, an anxiety disorder, things like that, but just normalizing conversations about mental health. Research has just shown over and over again, when we talk about mental health and kind of normalize those conversations and normalize the topic, the stigma of that, you know, reduces significantly. And I think that that helps our relationships, you know, overall, because, you know, then, you know, even in churches and congregations, you know, sometimes mental health is kind of like, oh, we don't talk about that here, you know, that kind of thing. Or again, it's seen as like that deficit, you know, based approach, like we've talked about. So that difference. So I think that throughout this content and thinking about these aspects of mental health, one, it helps everyone kind of understand each other better. And so when we can understand and empathize better, you know, with our peers and with adults, and also when adults can understand adolescents better, I think, you know, again, that just develops healthier relationships for everybody. And it's not seen as like, oh, well, this individual has, you know, blah, 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 you know, some kind of disorder, or again, some kind of like a deficit, that there's something wrong with that person. So I think just, you know, for me, normalizing those conversations is huge. So, you know, judgment is reduced, you know, that stigma is reduced. And all of that, too, if we think about, you know, again, God's example of love and grace, his relationship with us, you know, that's where we make those connections to, you know, relationships and mental health. You know, again, we're not perfect. We're sinners. But, you know, we know that God has designed each of us, and we're, you know, fearfully and wonderfully made. So I think all of those things connect. And likewise, when we don't talk about things like mental health, when it's seen as something is, you know, wrong with somebody else, you know, when you hear kids say, what's wrong with that person? It's like, no, it's nothing wrong with that person. It's, again, how can we empathize? How can we have that connection? So I think all of those are, you know, very intricately related.
In the curriculum, we talk about healthy relationships, and we also have a section on your relationship with God. And in the student books, we ask the students to think about, you know, how would you describe your relationship with God? How are love and grace expressed to you by God in your relationship with Him? Why is it important for you to utilize your relationship with God to inform your relationship with others? So we ask some of those hard questions and give the students time to reflect on that. We know as adults, those are tough questions, and those are things we should be reflecting on ourselves, and we don't take the time to do that often. So that's why we put some specific journal time for students in the student books for them to do that.
Maybe it's a great time to tell listeners where we can find your curriculum and exactly what it's called and what you're most proud of about it.
Yeah, so the web is from Concordia Publishing House, and it is called Resilient Minds, Christ-Centered Mental Health Curriculum. Right now, it is available for grades 5 and 6 combined and 7 and 8 combined. As Belinda said, we are currently writing the high school version, so that will be available in 2025. But the website is cph.org/resilientminds. And you can find more information. There are also some sample lessons that you can download. So again, anybody, again, whether teacher, you know, parent, DCE, church worker, you could take a look. This wasn't originally, you know, it was meant to be, you know, school-based, but in designing it and as we further were writing it, we realized, oh, this really could be used in church settings, youth group, you know, a multitude of different settings. So, you know, take a look at those samples and you might see how that might work, you know, work in your setting.
And one of the things that I'm most proud of that we added, and it was a little bit of a conversation to make this happen, is there's a set of PowerPoints for every single lesson. So there's a slide deck. You don't have to create your own. So you can actually use the slide deck as a guide. It's set up to where you can add slides. But what I love is that you already have it there for you. And the slide deck starts out by just introducing the lesson. There are some norms that you might consider utilizing across the time that you're with students, since you are talking about confidential material. There's a Bible verse for the lesson, and then there's content, including the activity. And then we circle back to the Bible verse and encourage you to say to the students you're working with, you know, say to the adolescents you're working with, what does this all mean? How does this relate? You know, what are your concepts when you think now? We introduced that Bible verse early on, but now 30 minutes later, you know, what are you thinking now that you have a little bit of content related to this topic? How does it all fit together? And that's something I'm really proud of, because I feel like when we did our demo lessons and when we've modeled and talked about this curriculum, that's what people hang on to, is that each lesson has a Bible verse and each lesson has visual materials that a DCE, a pastor, a counselor, a teacher can use. And I mean, it sounds funny, but in our world, a little prep, you know what I mean? It's like, we've done the prep for you. We've even given you like what to say if you want to use our wordy. So I'm pretty proud of that. I think it's very helpful, and it'll get people to use the curriculum more frequently.
I've read it and read through it, I should say, and I can attest to, I'm not a teacher, so I can't even begin to understand all of the preparations that go into teaching just one single lesson. But it does seem very user-friendly, so you don't have to necessarily be a teacher who has gone through technical education for that. If you're a pastor, or DCE, youth worker of any kind, I think you'll find this very accessible, even you know, parents as well, to do this as a homeschooling family or just with your own children to go through as a family. I think it would be a great experience as well. So finally, as we wrap up, how can we take these principles that we've talked about today that are in your curriculum, how can we take them and, for any listener, apply that to their own context, wherever they may be?
I hope that you'll take a look at the curriculum, and if you don't have time to do that, you'll maybe re-listen to the podcast and pick up a couple of the ideas that we shared. In our writing of this, the intentional time to really pilot for over a year was so important to us. We had a school that used this for their religion time. We had a school that had a pastor teaching this to a group of students. We had a school where the classroom teachers were actually teaching this during health time. We know from talking to counselors that many of them are planning to use it for like small groups. You know, there's lots of different ways that this can be utilized and that you can move forward with applying the practices. Even if you just take a small piece of it, like just use the strategies, we'd be so forever grateful.
Yeah, and I was going to add to that, too. Take the strategies yourself, you know, practice them yourself and integrate them into your own life to see, oh, yeah, I see how this works when I'm, you know, when I'm feeling upset, when I'm feeling dysregulated. So, you know, practicing them and modeling them, which I know we talked about, I think that's a great way to take these and, you know, again, show students, show adolescents, like, yeah, We're not just preaching, this is what you should do. We're seeing adults and we're seeing other people in our lives really, really model them. And the other, you know, just last point I would say is I think when we, you know, when I've talked to, you know, teachers or different groups about, you know, student behavior and, you know, these mental health types of things, there again, I think that modeling, I think practicing with the student. And again, just kind of validating, normalizing that all these different challenges are okay, but there are things we can do to help build that resiliency and help us practice and integrate those into our lives.
Dr. Belinda Karge and Dr. Kara Bratton, you have been a joy to speak with and to learn from. So thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks for joining us. Friends for Life is a podcast that discusses the life God has given and the people He has called you to serve, right where you are, in God's mission.